gone on to pursue careers in ministry, in poetry, in teaching, in science and religion. He's won a number of prestigious literary awards for his published poetry, which appears in collected volumes as well as in very prestigious poetry journals. He is ordained and has served as a priest in many different capacities, including working as a mental health chaplain. And since 1993, he has worked as a professor at Exeter, focusing on science and religion, in particular, looking at the place of suffering, questions of suffering, in scientific evolution. He was awarded a Templeton Award for his research and teaching, and he has two books in particular that I'd like to highlight on these topics. The first is God, Humanity, and Cosmos, and the second is The Groaning of Creation. And tonight he's going to be speaking to us on difficult thoughts about glory. So please join me in welcoming Professor Southgate.
Thank you, Jenny, for that very generous introduction. I'm delighted to be here, and if I could just send those handouts around. I should never disagree with the person who introduces you, but I do have to make clear that I'm not, in fact, an ordained priest. I'm no more of a priest than any other Christian as a priest. It's understandable mistake, because much of my life is spent training people to be priests, but I'm not on my side. But I am, I suppose, an explorer, and I guess we all are here because at some level or other we are explorers of the God who is infinite beyond our understanding. And it's to further that exploration of the mystery of the godness of God that I want to engage with you tonight, and I hope it'll be a shared exploration. I look forward to the time that I stop talking and hear from you, and I'll be really interested to see what you have to say. Difficult thoughts then about glory. The first difficult thought I want to offer you about glory is that it's a very difficult word to understand. It's a word that's on many people's lips every day. Dying with the kingdom, the power and the glory. But what is glory? What is, in particular, is glory when we speak of God's glory? And if you asked 100 people in taxi cabs around the country, and I would want to say that taxi drivers are an excellent source of theological insight, so don't miss the opportunity when you take a taxi to ask the taxi driver what he or she thinks. If you asked 100 taxi drivers what glory was, the chances are that most of them would say something to do with radiant light or beauty, and so that's the prevailing sort of picture postcard version of God's glory that we tend to have. So the first difficult thought I want to offer you is that to think only of glory in terms of light or radiance or splendor is a mistake. That if you look back into the principal Hebrew word for glory in Hebrew Bible, the word kavod, that's a word with the connotation of weight or substance, not of light or radiance. So kavod is a word about, when applied to God, it's a word about the hugely weighty reality of God, not necessarily about brilliance or beauty at all. So now I'm going to take us into two biblical passages, which both of them have real interpretative difficulties surrounding them. So this is where our explorations begin, if you like. And I wonder if anybody can see their text of Exodus 33 well enough to read us that first passage that begins, "Moses said." Would someone be willing to do that? Thank you very much, sir.
"Moses said, 'Show me your glory, I pray.' I said, 'I will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim before you the name, the Lord, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy.' But he said, 'You cannot see my face, for no one shall see me and live.' And the Lord continued, 'See, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. While my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen.'"
Thank you very much. Very intriguing passage. And the interpretative crux of this passage is Moses' request granted? Does he see the glory of the Lord or not? If you decide that Moses' request is granted and that he does get to see the glory of the Lord, then you're able to say, well, we can equate God's glory with God's goodness, with the name by which he can be named by human beings. But if you think, as I do, that Moses' request is not granted here, for whatever combination of reasons, then your understanding of glory will perhaps be stranger and more difficult. It's not then easy to equate God's glory with God's goodness. Rather, what is bearable of the divine reality is goodness, but glory is something more mysterious, something ultimately less bearable for humans. There's a nice quote from a book by Barbara Brown Taylor, the American preacher. She's got a little book called Learning to Walk in the Dark, which is about the importance of darkness in our lives. And she says this in a fine American style. My wife's American, so we're bilingual at home. I should be able to read this. "The God of Moses is not the grandfatherly type, a kind old deity who can be relied on to take the kids exciting places without letting them get hurt. The God of Moses is holy, offering no seat belts or other safety features to those who wish to climb the mountain and enter the dark cloud. Those who go assume all risk and give up all safety. Those who return say that the dazzling dark was worth the journey." So, what she wants to emphasize there is that the holiness of God, the glory of God, is not to be reduced to simple qualities such as goodness. It's always more and more mysterious. So that, if you like, is difficult thought too. Glory is not to be thought of in terms of light or beauty or radiance or simply in terms of goodness, but is to do with holiness and mystery. So that takes us to our second passage, which is from the Gospel of John, chapter 12. This is a longer read, but I'd be really grateful if someone could do it for us so we can hear and feed off the scripture together. Another reader for John 12? Yes, please. Yeah.
Now, among those who went up to worship at a festival were some Greeks. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and said to him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip went and told Andrew. Then Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Those who love their life lose it, and those who hate their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. Whoever serves me, the Father will honor. Now my soul is troubled, and what should I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it is for this reason that I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven. "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd standing there heard it and said that it was thunder. Others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered, "This voice has come for your sake, not for mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be driven out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." He said this to indicate the kind of death he was to die. The crowd answered him, "We have heard from the law that the Messiah remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" Jesus said to them, "The light is with you for a little longer. Walk while you have the light, so that the darkness may not overtake you. If you walk in the darkness, you do not know where you are going. While you have the light, believe in the light, so that you may become children of light." After Jesus had said this, he departed and hid from them. Although he had performed so many signs in their presence, they did not believe in him. This was to fulfill the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah, "Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" And so they could not believe, because Isaiah also said, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, so that they might not look with their eyes and understand with their heart in turn, and I would heal them." Isaiah said this because he saw his glory and spoke about him.
Thank you very much. It's an extraordinarily rich passage, and we could spend the next 2 hours pondering over it very easily. But I just want to point out one connection that John makes here. This is a passage when Jesus is anticipating his hour, as the Gospel refers repeatedly to this coming hour, which is the climax of Jesus' ministry. "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And again, there's a big debate in Johannine studies as to whether Jesus' hour, the hour of his glorification, is the hour of his resurrection and triumph, or whether Jesus' hour, the hour of his glorification, includes his suffering and death. And again, my own view is that the first view, which says that the hour is just about resurrection and triumph, can't be sustained, not least because Jesus says, "Save me from this hour." But also because of this very interesting link I want to point out to you between verse 23, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified," and the crowd's answer that John gives, "How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up?" So the crowd provide a question to which Jesus has not really fully prepared them. But what John is doing there is making this connection between glorification and being lifted up. And that's a connection that points you straight back to Isaiah 52:13 in the Greek translation, in which those two lifted up and glorified are paired together. So John is pointing us very strongly back to the suffering servant in Isaiah, the one who is lifted up, so marred in his appearance, but that lifting up is also glory. So I side with those people who want to say that we must face the fact that the glory of Christ, the glory of the Father's only Son, includes being lifted up on the cross in degrading execution. So there's difficult thought three, that glory, which we've associated with weight, substance, reality, holiness, now we have to associate also with pain and sorrow. Jesus is the ultimate sign of the glory of God. John begins his gospel by telling us that we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. And again he goes on to say, no one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart. He has made him known. So Jesus is the great discloser of the godness of God, the great sign of the nature of God. So, working from those thoughts, and moving away from the notion of glory as light, radiance, or beauty to encompass all sorts of other dimensions of glory, and in particular the glory that Jesus shows us. So I propose at the bottom of your sheet an understanding of God's glory as being whatever teaches us about the godness of God. Sometimes, as in Exodus 33, it's a direct reference to the godness of God. More commonly, glory represents some sort of sign of the godness of God. And so in other Exodus passages, there's the reference to the glory of God in the cloud or the fire behind the cloud, and very strongly in John's gospel we get the sense of Jesus as the great sign of the godness of God. So that's the understanding of glory that I want to explore in the rest of our time. And I want to explore it in three contexts. I want to explore it in the natural world, briefly. I want to explore it in the life of a Holocaust victim, Etty Hillerson. And lastly, I want to talk a little bit about what this might all be to do with us sitting in Oxford on a Monday evening. So turning over the handout, I go on to suggest that in order to discern glory, we need to discern it through three different lenses, that just one way of trying to see God's glory will not be adequate. Not least because the Bible opens up up for us such a complex story of God's history with human beings. So I want to suggest these three lenses, and according to the different situation, different lenses come into play. And the first is signs of God in the fabric of the creation, what I call Gloria Mundi. And the second is signs of God, as we encountered them just now in John's Gospel, signs of God in Jesus' passion. And in whatever in the world speaks to us of the passion of Christ through situations of human suffering and also through situations of self-sacrificial love. So that's what I call Gloria Crucis. And then, of course, Christians live, as no doubt has been often said to you, Christians live in the now but not yet of longing for the future when God's purposes will be manifest on the earth and relationships will be healed. So when we look forward to what we believe God will do, then we're using the lens of Gloria in Excelsis and thinking about the coming glory when God will be all in all, as Paul tells us, and we shall need no more signs because God will be present to us in a new way. So that's my model of three-lensed seeing. But I want to come back now to focus on the first of these lenses and on glory in the natural world. And my whole project is to try and look for glory in difficult places, because I want to get away from that that simple view that equates glory with light. And I also want to get away from what I see all too often in Christian circles, which is that when something good or beautiful or lovely happens, we're full of thanksgiving and praise to God for it. But when something troubling, ugly, disturbing happens, maybe we're not good enough at seeing that God might have an involvement also in that. We tend to park those things in another category, and we don't bring our God thoughts out of our pocket when sufficiently, which is entirely foreign to, I think, to what the Bible has to tell us about God. So, glory in the natural world, two awkward cases. And the first is thinking back to the terrible disaster in the Indian Ocean when a tsunami generated by a movement of tectonic plates, itself of massive energy, it had the energy of 10,000 hydrogen bombs, that tectonic movement, and it created a tsunami which, of course, caused devastation across the Indian Ocean basin and cost the lives of a quarter of a million people. So how can I say that that's anything to do with God's glory? And the answer is because the sheer power of that event and the what it reveals about the way the earth is made, which is a way necessary, by the way, for there to be life to emerge and flourish on the earth. The sheer power of that event speaks to the power of God as creator, just as the ingenuity required to give rise to a life-bearing planet also speaks of God's great creative power. So we look through the lens of Gloria Mundi, we can see God behind that event, despite the fact that it was an event of such terrible character and resulted in such huge human suffering. That's what I mean by saying that we mustn't be afraid to be honest about God's involvement even in events that we find very troubling. So we might respond to that event in a whole range of ways. We might respond with anger that God did nothing to prevent the suffering. We might respond with lament, using the resources of the Psalms. There are responses also of compassionate action, which are so important. And there's also the response of longing, but the longing for that time when these suffering-filled events will not any longer occur. So our responses are complex, but what we need to do, I'm inviting you to see, is to see God's involvement and God's glory, the godness of God, in its mystery, even behind an event of such terrible proportions. And just as though I hadn't made you cross enough with that reflection, I want to suggest to you also that in relation to the life cycle of the malarial mosquito, which again is a source of such huge human suffering, you can see also within the intricacy of the evolved strategy of the parasite there, you can see the intricacy and beauty of creation at work, even although the results are so full of suffering for human beings. So hard as this type of thinking is, I invite you to penetrate behind these events in the creation and see God the Creator within them, even although we also may want to say all sorts of things about God's redeeming love and God's suffering with all who suffer. So we don't have only one lens by which to look at glory. But if we are to look at glory honestly, we need to look also with this lens of seeing God's work in the fabric of creation, even in those parts of creation that are violent and disturbing. So one more difficult instance, and then we'll talk about what this all means for us in Oxford on a Monday night. I'm interested to know who here knows the name Etty Hillerson. It's a familiar to her. A distinguished little group of people. So one of the good things about this talk, and you may be wondering where the good things in this talk are, but one of the good things is that I get to introduce the rest of you to this extraordinary character. Etty Hillerson was a young Jewish intellectual in living in Amsterdam, and towards the end of her life, and as a result of entering into therapeutic relationships, she began to keep these diaries, and the diaries and letters from the last 2 years of her life are a most extraordinary document. And so I give you on the handout just a little flavour of the sorts of things that Etty wrote. This first quote is from when she's been taken to the transit camp at Westerbork. The only destination on from Westerbork was Auschwitz. And she writes, "The misery here is quite terrible. And yet, late at night, when the day has slunk away into the depths behind me, I often walk with a spring in my step along the barbed wire. And then, time and again, it soars straight from my heart. I can't help it. It's just the way it is. like some elementary force, the feeling that life is glorious and magnificent, and that one day we shall be building a whole new world. So this extraordinary set of writings that she produced in the last 2 years of her life before she was indeed sent on the train to Auschwitz. And the second quote is just someone else remembering Etty's life. There was something about her that spoke of an ancient primeval struggle, the weight of thousands of years, and at the same time something light and joyful. So there's a lot there about what I'm trying to convey about the glory of God. Something with the weight of thousands of years and yet at the same time light and joyful, that Etty was able to see glory even through the misery of her situation in the camp. It's very extraordinary. And what is in a way yet more extraordinary is that last little quote. We have so much work to do on ourselves that we shouldn't even be thinking of hating our so-called enemies. So this is one of the very remarkable things about Etty's writings, is that even when the Gestapo officer is shouting at her, she still finds it possible to see the human being behind the hate and the oppression that she's experiencing. So she's an astonishing example, I think, of the ability to perceive glory even in the most difficult of circumstances, and to be able to see the image of God even in the Gestapo officer, to be able to see God's work behind the face of the oppressor. So again, this is an extraordinary ability to perceive glory, even in a situation of such trappedness and such misery. So, and she also has what must have seemed a completely irrational hope at the time, the hope that we should be building a whole new world. So although she doesn't necessarily have the Christian language to express it, she was very interested in the Christian Gospels, but didn't become a confessing Christian. But she has that hope of the future, which I was talking about earlier under the heading Gloria in Excelsis. So I'd encourage any of you to pick up the little book by Patrick Woodhouse that I refer to at the end of the reference list. It's an introduction to Etty's life, a very perceptive and helpful one. So that's well worth exploring, I think. So lastly then, glory in the life of the ordinary believer. Because I wouldn't at all want to think that the perception of glory was something that required a detailed knowledge of plate tectonics or mosquito biochemistry, or indeed that it was only available to people of extraordinary mystical power like Etty Hillerson. Glory is for all of us to seek to perceive through these three lenses that I've indicated. And a really helpful and fascinating verse, endlessly fascinating verse on this is 2 Corinthians 3:18. It's too often 3:18 is read without 3:17, so I put them together. Someone just read us those two verses at the end of the handout. Bethany, thank you.
Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And all of us, with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, the Spirit.
Thank you very much. So, this is the most extraordinary sense of the journey into glory, from one degree of glory to another, that is the Christian life and is made possible by the Spirit and by the freedom that the Spirit brings. So again, that huge acres and acres of ink has been spilt over 318. And in particular over that phrase, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, it makes use of a rare Greek verb, and there's huge argument as to whether that's seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, or reflecting the glory of the Lord as though in a mirror. So are we beholders or reflectors? And I want to suggest to you that Christians are both. That to behold the glory of the Lord is also to begin to reflect it in our lives. And that this is our calling. It is to become signs of the sign of God. That was Jesus. So if Jesus represents glory, represents the godness of God seen as a sign, so Christians in turn can be signs of Christ, signs of that glory. As we behold Christ, so we have the opportunity to reflect Christ. And one last thought on that, and then I will finish. You've been very patient with me. A friend of mine has done a lot of work on the theory of signs using the philosophy of Charles Saunders Peirce. And Peirce said that there was a particular sort of sign called a qualisign, which is a sign that points to its object by virtue of its sheer quality. So the most familiar example of that is that those samples of paint that when you go to buy paint, you get a whole book of paint samples, and the sample is a sign of the colour by virtue of the sheer quality of the colour that's being represented. There are all sorts of other types of sign, but the qualisign refers to its object just in terms of its own quality. And what my colleague says very, very helpfully, I think, is that we need to see Jesus as a qualisign of the life of God. In other words, that the whole colour of Jesus' life reflects the quality of God's life. And I think this is particularly helpful because we're forever getting most things wrong, and life in church, I think, in my experience, often goes badly. But we can seek to make our lives take on more the colour of Jesus' life, more the overall quality of his life as we learn it from the Gospels. And after a talk which has been full of mystery and bleakness and darkness, I want to leave you with that rather positive thought that we can aspire to for our lives to take on the colour of Jesus' life, and for us therefore to become truer signs of the sign of God, that is Jesus, and hence to be, in Paul's terms, transformed from one degree of glory to another. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Professor Southgate. We have about 15 minutes for questions. If anyone would like to ask Chris about anything that struck you in the talk. Hannah.
Thank you, that was wonderfully rich. I have, the first one is just a point of interest. I'm interested what brought you to think through what glory might mean in relation to various forms of suffering and you use another word very often that's not escaping me. It would be very interesting for me and I'm sure all of us to hear. But my main question was about time and temporality and our sense of time, because at least my sense of the three stories, it's like there seems to be an ability to grasp what you're talking about, this godliness of God. You have to have some sense of ourselves within history and time that expands far beyond what we can conceive of time, but also a sense of time being the future that's not yet, and somehow God in time. And I would love to hear how you would think about how, if in what ways time works in our relation to understanding the glory of God, but also how we expand our own time horizons to grasp something of this, because it seems that often our sense of time is such a limitation, a constraint.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Two great questions, thank you. I suppose part of what drew me into this was thinking for a long time about suffering in evolution. And so you write a book which has six nice answers to this question, but then you're still left thinking about the kind of deeper mysteries of suffering, and that maybe it's better to think back into the biblical roots of what we're told about God rather than just having the six nice answers. So I suppose that's been a driving force for me. And another, in relation to time, I think what you say is really helpful. I think that I think we're always living in the now, but not yet. And we're always brought up again. In a sense, Christians are resurrection people. But we're always brought up against the sufferings that take us back to thinking about the cross and taking up our own cross. So I think that without this kind of richness of perspective on time, there's a danger of getting stuck in one of these modes of thinking. I think it's in some churches are such resurrection churches that they fail to be Good Friday churches, and something very important is lost there. And I think that the story of creation is something that that binds us together with all human beings, and so to be puzzling over that lens as well, and it's also really important. Thank you.
Do you mind if I ask a little bit of a follow-up to that?
Sure.
Because it was, as you were talking about glory, I'm working in the very early church and the pre-church era at the moment, and glory is what humanity is all about, of course, in the classical epics. It's what people want, it's what motivates them. Whether you're Achilles and you want glory for yourself, or you're Aeneas and you want glory for the Roman Empire. And right now as you were speaking, so I guess part of my question is, do you think that's the same, the glory that fills these sort of classical texts and early Christian texts is the same glory that you're talking about? And it just struck me as Hannah was speaking that perhaps glory is something maybe do you think that transcends time? Because why Achilles wanted glory for himself and why Aeneas wanted glory for Rome was that was the only way to beat mortality and time and death.
And yeah.
Could that make glory a bad thing?
Well, that's another great question. And I think what's interesting is that the glory of the Homeric hero is kleos, it's not doxa. And what's so fascinating, and didn't go into this, was the decision of the Greek translators of the Hebrew Bible to use a word, doxa, which had not been used really for glory in that same sense. So they carve out a whole new sense for that Greek word so that it can take on the weight of the Hebrew word. So there's something very fascinating, endlessly fascinating is going on there. But I do think that glory, human glory, is a very, a very misleading thing. Whereas the signs that God gives us of God's glory are utterly faithful, reliable signs, but the signs we get of human celebrity and glory are almost entirely they're very unreliable. And indeed, we celebrate, we build people up and give them glory, and then we knock them down. So to see that God's glory belongs in a different realm from that, I think, is really important. That it's not just about reputation in the way that human glory is. We see how transient, timeless reputations are. Look on my face, O ye mighty, and despair, from Shelley's poem Ozymandias, that however humans try and construct timeless glory, it always fails. So this is the glory, the being transformed from one degree of glory to another glory, which comes from looking on the Lord with unveiled face. Thank you.
Megan, I just wanted to ask, because my project, of course, has to do with this, so I'm thinking about this a lot, but about sin and fallenness. You know, obviously there's lots of different ways in which we can understand ourselves as fallen in an evolutionary world, but is it part of fallenness or part of finitude to not be able to recognize the glory of the Lord or to see the glory of the Lord? And then is part of redemption, part of being able to see more clearly glory? If that makes sense, I'm kind of just wondering.
Absolutely, yes. I have endless struggles with my students about this because if I tell them that I believe in fallenness, they bring a huge sigh of relief. If I tell them that there probably never was a fall event, they get cross. I think that all sorts of capacities emerge in the human being as humans evolve. One of which is the capacity for worship, one of which is the capacity for conscious self-giving love. Along with that, of course, also emerges more and more sophisticated forms of idolatry. So always on the shoulder of efforts to contemplate God lies the risk of idolatry. And we're very good at making other gods. Yeah, thank you.
If glory can be understood in terms of signs of God, the question is whether God can be glorious when like no one is perceiving him, or before the creation.
Ah, that's another wonderful question. yes. So there, I'd have to say that that glory takes on this spectrum of meanings. So it can be talking about the kind of essential godness of God, or it can be talking about God's self-communication in the form of signs. And so when in John's Gospel Jesus is talking about the glory that he shared with the Father before the foundation of the world, that must be on the essential side of the spectrum. Whereas I'd say most uses of glory are about God's self-communication through signs. One could be tempted to devise an elaborate theology of sign within the Trinity, but I think that would be a mistake, you know. You tie yourself in all sorts of knots. God needs no signs to interact with God. Yeah.
So this is a question for clarification, but I'm wondering what we... given the concept of glory, what can we and cannot we say about what glory is?
So it's often easier in speaking about God to say what the godness of God is not.
Where I'm going with this.
Yeah,
so in some of the examples that you cite, like for example the tsunami, we have the tsunami, the mosquito, the Gestapo officer. In one case, I mean, what is it, I guess, in common about these things that sort of makes them glorious?
Because
my worry was,
yes,
that in at least the tsunami and the mosquito example, you seem to come a bit close to sort of saying, you know, this is a manifestation of God's glory, the tsunami is. Well, what about it is a manifestation of God's glory, right? So, I mean, it could be a manifestation of God's power and, you know, his ability to create and, sort of the massiveness of his power and creative action, and the mosquito could be an example of God's creation. There's kind of beauty to it, you know. But that doesn't mean that the malaria that results from it is attributed to God, right? Nor the loss of life from the tsunami is attributable to God, because if we're sort of saying the whole thing is glorious, then you know. So I'm just kind of wanting us to be more specific there, and I think personally. There has to be some sort of like moral component to glory, and we have to be careful what that is. But there's something kind of ethical about God's. It's something good in His gloriousness. That's sort of, I guess, what I'm thinking towards. But I'm just interested in what you think about that. Because if we open it up too far, then it could be anything, right? And that's worrying.
I think you're absolutely right, and you pinned me helpfully down on language. So I'm not saying that the tsunami was glorious, and I'm not saying that the activity of the mosquito is glorious. But what I'm saying is that viewed through one of our glory lenses, we can see signs of the deep reality of God within that event. And we see all sorts of other things, of course, and in both those cases, we see human neglect and human folly abounded in the case of the tsunami, and it does in the case of malaria too. So what I'm saying is, there are signs there of the deep reality of God as the creator of everything that exists, and that we should pay attention, honest attention to those signs, even though we want to say all sorts of other things about those events. Does that help?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Thank you. That was very, very helpful.
Actually, I've got a question.
Yeah.
This will be the last question for the sake of time.
How important is for the person to perceive one's finitude in order to recognize the glory as you described it?
Oh, it's. I think it's vastly important because I think that we're human beings are often in grave danger of making idols out of our own lives, treating our lives as possessions, and supposing that they are they're something that we'll always retain or that we can. Make huge efforts to safeguard, and I think part of this another part of doing theology in this sort of way would be about receiving one's life as gift, and that's part of beholding. Or however incompletely, the glory of God and the glory and the example of Christ, and that enables us to reflect with unveiled faces that sense of receiving life and love to the full. But I come back to my point that. Idolatry of all sorts stalks this on every side, and part of it is to think too highly or to think in a distorted way of one's own life. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you so very much again for a very fascinating talk and the start of hopefully what will continue in the informal part of our evening as a great discussion. Let's thank Professor Southgate once again.